Hello and welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry. I'm your host, Andrew Jelina. With me this week is Brandon Kindred, founder of Looksee. Brandon, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So I know way back in the day, I think your dad was in the industry too, and you learned a bit about software from him?
Yeah, my dad got into the tech industry, I would say, in the mid-80s. Bought a computer, started programming, and I just kind of grew up sitting on his lap, just watching him program. I wouldn't say I was learning as much as just watching him and just being kind of mystified by everything that was going on with what he was doing. So I ended up going in, and after a while, he ended up actually getting really annoyed with me because I was always taking apart and putting the computers back together. So he got me a book and he was like, you're going to have to learn how this stuff works. So he got me, I think it was two books actually. One was like how computers work in 24 hours and the other one was HTML in 24 hours. I think it took me like a week to get through everything.
48 hours later, you must have been an expert.
I don't read so fast, but yeah, it didn't take very long.
You first got into coding, were you just kind of putting together some simple HTML pages?
Yeah, well, I mean, I hacked around and whatnot with the Apple that we had in the house here and there, but I never really knew what I was doing. I didn't know what commands were, you know, so I'd consider me more like just pounding away at a keyboard and hoping for the best.
Did you do any programming in high school?
I did. I kept programming over the years, and in high school, I kind of was confused with what you do with programming professionally, if I'm being honest. You know, when I got there, it was like, well, I've learned Java, I've learned JavaScript. I don't really know what you do with these, though, other than these little, like, basic scripts that I was writing at the time. So I was a little lost in my journey at that point.
Is that when you discovered robotics?
Yeah. So I ended up in a situation actually where I was removed from class. I was in a chemistry class and had been just consistently disruptive. Just the basic things, you know, giving people the answers to the questions on the quizzes, helping people with their homework, as in just writing the answers down, trying to get into the chemical cabinet, you know, just general disruptive things, nothing too major. And my professor, the teacher at one point, he had had enough and he just tricked me by telling me that he was going to take me into the other room and show me a more advanced chemistry experiment. And I didn't really know much at the time. So I was just like, sure, this sounds great. Going to get like special tutorial on the side. And no, he bamboozled me. He actually walked me right into the teacher's lounge and sat me down. And he was like, this is where you're going to sit for the rest of the year. And gave me a computer. And he's like, since you seem to already know all the answers for the chemistry class, we're going to give you a new assignment. And he set me down for 3ds Max. And it took me like a month, I would say, to be able to get through and like build a whole scene and everything. And I got bored. I'm sitting there writing a program. I think it was something for a calculator to help me with one of my math classes so I didn't have to spend so long on my homework. And I would just tab shift, just move in and out of the windows when he'd come in. But one day he caught me off guard and stuck in right behind me while I was sitting there coding something up that I had thought of the night before. And man, I thought I was in trouble. This guy stood me right up, you know, and he was like, what are you doing? And I was trying to explain to him that I was programming, and he must have already known what I was doing, obviously. And he's like, come with me. And he just marched me down the hall. I was like, oh man, next stop is the principal's office. That's not how it worked out, actually. He walked me down just a couple doors down to another science teacher's classroom and had me explaining to him, which was even more awkward at this point. Just telling what you've been up to for the last 2 months. And I was like, I don't know what you want me to say here. And ultimately, he ended up explaining for me that I was sitting there writing programming and clearly had a propensity for it. And it turns out that the robotics team didn't have a programmer. So I got a new assignment that day, essentially, as they both conspired and kind of signed me up without much asking. And that became my homework during the class every day, was to focus on the robotics stuff.
Okay. So what kind of robots are you building back then? And what sort of technologies are you working with?
That was all for the first program for inspiration and recognition of science and technology. It's a really great international program for high school students to be able to learn technology and experiment with engineering. I was actually really surprised after I got out of high school. I didn't really understand in high school like how valuable the kit is that they give you. And I tried to buy some of these parts afterwards, and they're like $35,000 worth of parts.
Oh,
in these boxes. They're really expensive and they don't charge that much, it would seem. And it was like, I couldn't get these things for the life of me. For less than like $30,000. So we built a lot of robots that are just essentially around playing games. There was a competition set up for the first that they do where different teams from different schools design the robots and they go out and they compete at these different regional and national events. So I got sucked into that. And that was essentially the next 3 years of my high school was pretty much just focused on robotics.
So when you say games, is it like a sumo wrestling type game where you're trying to push the other guy out of the ring, or what are you playing?
No, a lot of these are cooperative, competitive games. Think of like soccer, but with robots, you know, involved. But, you know, obviously we didn't have things at that time. The robots could actually walk. So it's a lot of things where you have things on wheels. One of the ones for the year that I actually got an award during a robotics, the game was that you had this ramp in the middle of the field and two end zones at the end and a bunch of bins in the middle. And the goal was to collect as many of the bins in your end zone as possible so that way you could win the game. Very similar to like football meets, I don't know, meets robotics.
Capture the flag or something like that?
Yeah, something like that, yeah. The games are like similar in that fashion. They change every year. One of the things that I ended up doing during that program was I wrote an AI system in my junior year of high school, I think it was. It took me like 6 months to build out. And it was for that game where we had these end zones and whatnot. And I ended up just in a situation where we're like in the finals and the team that we were playing with, you know, because they swapped the teams out, the team that we were with in this match wanted us to be able to execute a different strategy than we had in our roster of capabilities. And I just kind of frantically pounded away at the keyboard. I had like less than 10 minutes to make this change between things while everybody else is ripping apart the robot and replacing things. So, you know, there's no time for testing. And I deploy it to the robot and I kind of hope for the best, put the robot on the field. And I'm like, this probably is not going to work. This isn't going to work at all. And it really did. It actually worked out fantastically. Everything went better than I could have possibly hoped. And because of the fact that we were able to do that so quickly, the team was actually recognized for leadership in robotics and robotic capabilities. So it was a really cool moment. And also one where I was like, man, I shouldn't have doubted myself so much. You got a bunch of people from like NASA and Johnson & Johnson stuff standing around you, you know, saying this is really awesome. And I was like, yeah, this is probably the worst thing ever.
Well, the hacking gods smiled upon you that day. Your demo worked.
It was a good day, yeah.
That's cool. So are the companies like sponsoring or are they looking to recruit folks out of there or how are they involved?
A lot of it is just sponsorship. So Johnson & Johnson sponsored that award and they would send representatives. Often it would be like their CEO or a VP of engineering from there. And every organization was like, they have a ton of corporate sponsors there at first. I wouldn't be the right person to tell you how extensive their list is, but they have a really cool setup.
That's cool. So then you moved on to college. I think you went to University of Hartford.
I did, yeah. I went there and majored in computer science.
And more robotics, or what were you working on there?
I couldn't find anything actually with robotics. It turned out that I had found my passion early, earlier than the industry realized that it was a cool thing to do. So there was only like 3 schools in the nation that offered an actual robotics degree. And most places didn't even have any sort of program as their computer science to be able to do that. So no, I just focused on math and AI while I was there and hoped that one day the robotics pieces that I had gotten used to playing with would become affordable to me.
So tell me a bit about the award that you won from that competition.
So this award's a nice little trophy. It's got a couple geometric prisms on it. It's nothing fantastic. It's got some hefts to it, but it's probably worth like $10, to be honest with you. Nothing major, but the award ended up being something. It was like, I was the only programmer on the team at the time. So they gave us 2 awards, you know, they kept one to put in the school case and they gave me the other one to take home because I was the only one that was doing the programming. Doesn't make sense for anybody else to have this, you know, it's your reward. So you deserve it.
Yeah. Did you learn any tough lessons about robotics during your experimentation there?
I learned a lot of tough lessons throughout robotics. I learned that people don't like being ran over with them. That one I learned early on.
Through experience, no doubt.
Yes. You know, it happened a few times as I was starting to learn how to build an AI, and I didn't realize how unpredictable things would be. And a few people got ran over in the process.
Now, are the other folks mechanical engineers, or who are you working with there?
Well, we had a few mentors that are mechanical engineers, mechanical shop owners, teachers. They're just really anybody that could give the time and the mentorship to the students for us to be in the shop and be supervised, essentially. We did have a few people that were experts, but the rest of them were there to just support us in our efforts. Everybody else on the team is students, so everybody's in high school and just trying their best.
So any other tough lessons you learned in robotics through the competitions?
Yeah, there is. As I was getting to my senior year, I started doing a bunch of, I don't know if fringe is the word for it, but outside competitions. And I ended up being enrolled in this competition for mechanical engineering at Boston University. And the objective is I got this really thin track. It's like 6 meters long or something like that, I want to say. And you just simply have to get a robot or a car of some sort down the track. By being self-propelled, it can't have any electrical sources or anything like that. And that really screwed with me because I was really used to having motors. And I tried everything that I could. I tried rubber bands. I tried a spring with a string attached. I tried all kinds of things. I could not get this thing to go down a track for the life of me. And I went anyways. I took the failure of a car that I had. It was, well, maybe we'll have better success. And got there, and I didn't. My turn came, put the robot down on the track, wound everything up, and let it go. And it didn't really go anywhere. I made it like maybe a quarter way down the track. And I think that day I was just like, I'm just not good at mechanical engineering. I'm just not good at this.
ME is hard, that's for sure. So what were some of the designs that were making it the whole way down the 6 meters? What did they do?
To be honest with you, I was so devastated by the fact that I could not wrap my head around how to do this. And I think I remember seeing a few people that their designs weren't even that elaborate. I was like, how did you think of something so stupidly simple? It was way overcomplicating this process. And so I was just all kinds of butthurt at the time about the fact that like I had just failed so miserably.
That is a tough and humbling experience in competition.
That it is.
Yeah, when I was in high school, we did a series of programming competitions. And basically, you were on a team of other programmers from your high school, and you were all sequestered in a room. And they give you these problems, and you would brainstorm together, and you had to write out the complete program on paper first. You had to be completely done writing it on paper before you were allowed into the room where the terminals were. So we'd sit there and think about the problem, and we'd code together on paper, you know, and erasing and writing stuff. And we'd try and step through it in our heads and debug it and give it sample input and predict the output, kind of walking through all the steps together, similar kind of to like a whiteboard interview these days. And then once you were completely done writing out your program, then one person from your team could go to the actual computer terminal and type in the code that you all had written out on paper. And you were definitely not supposed to just hack and whack in the editor, you know, and actually be coding while you were sitting at the terminal. You're mostly just supposed to be typing it. They really kind of wanted to emphasize thinking things out in your head ahead of time and being able to envision things and predict outcomes and really be able to have this cerebral exercise before you'd put it in the computer. So in most competitions, there were 4 to 5 problems that they give you. And there was no partial credit. You either had a working program or you didn't for each of the problems. So usually by the end of competition, you're kind of trying to cram in whatever the hardest problem was that you saved for last. And I knew how to use copy and paste in the editor. This is like an old PDP 1170. And there was some code that was very similar between 2 parts of the program. So we wrote it all out as best we could. And then I got in there. Because I was the fastest typist and copy-pastist of the team. And I got it in there and ripped through and got it mostly working, but just couldn't quite get the right answer by the time the clock ran out. And after the competition's over, you get a printout and you get one more chance to kind of debrief and debug. And we figured out as we're stepping through, like, here's this variable name. And we cut and pasted a section of code and didn't change one of the names. And so years later, you know, I'm working with object-oriented programming and refactoring and some advanced editors. And a bell rang in my head. I kind of recalled this scenario and said, oh, wouldn't it have been great to have this back then? I could have avoided these mistakes entirely, but it gave me an appreciation for having these tools now. Any other things from University of Hartford or CS?
I think a great thing about the University of Hartford is I really got to explore my interests. So I had another kind of crisis with computer science to where I was studying it and I had resolved to finish it, but I wasn't sure if I was actually going to work in it when I left. I had just become bored with theory and everything was theory, you know, computer science. So I ended up exploring sales actually and got into a scenario where alumni of my fraternity had life insurance business of his own, and he was working on doing lead generation. And I ended up taking over that process and actually building out a proper organization out of it. I think that within like 3 or 4 months, I had like 5 people that were generating leads. We had so many leads, he couldn't actually field all of them. He was shocked by that. And he goes, well, you know, you should just get your license and help me sell some of this stuff. So went out, got my license, and he went out and taught me the ropes. It didn't take long before I started thinking that I was really good at the sales thing, too. I was like, this isn't that hard. And I'd start to brag a little bit about how things went when he wasn't out in the field with me. And He'd always take that as a sign of like, oh, okay, you need to be showing something new at this point. So he'd take me out the next day to his appointments and just completely dumbfound me and just how terrible I am at sales in comparison to this guy. You know, there was literally nothing he could say that went wrong, it seemed like. And it was just awe-inspiring.
What did you learn from him besides how to think on your feet and handle objections?
Well, I mean, thinking on your feet and handling objections, I feel like is a really important skill in itself. But one of the things I kind of learned from him was to keep rolling with the punches. Sales is a numbers game, and you can't get bogged down in any little detail. You kind of got to like zoom out and understand where you're at in the landscape of what you're trying to accomplish. And he did a really good job of constantly dragging me out of the sand and placing me back in firm footing and being like, it's not that difficult to do this stuff, but it is time consuming. And constantly showing me the patience with that was really important.
To find my next job, first, I want to hear about dozens of jobs I am overqualified for.
Someday, I will talk to a recruiter who knows the difference between Java and JavaScript. That will be the one.
Would I mind commuting 3 hours each way each day? Of course not.
All I have to do is go through 5 separate interviews, complete a 10-hour coding exercise, and recite the national anthem backwards? I'm in.
Finding your next consulting gig should not be this difficult. Quite frankly, you deserve better. Syrinx is the consulting company founded and run by software consultants. We get you. Find out why our employees are some of the happiest and best paid consultants in the industry at Syrinx.com. That's Syrinx.com. Find a better way today.
Syrinx Consulting is a proud sponsor of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry.
Yeah, a lot of folks from computer science or software engineering or engineering background tend to be like, okay, I'm going to do A, then B, then C, and then I'll have a successful result at D. And sales is more like you try A, that completely doesn't work. You try B, that doesn't work. You try C, you get a no. You try D, you get a no. You have to keep banging away at it and figuring out, all right, well, maybe I need to change things up here and get used to rejection as part of the iteration.
Yeah. And he definitely taught me that trial by fire. He took me out and let me schedule 20 appointments and then let me fall on my face on every one of them. He sat there next to me and just watched me just... And I was like, God, this isn't easy, you know? And he must have seen, you know, that I was breaking. He took the next one. He was like, this one's on me. And like 10 minutes in and out, I was like, I hate you.
What made him so good, in your opinion?
You know, he's got the gift of gab, but he has the most honest, altruistic intentions. He does the job there because of the fact that he believes that he can help somebody. And he'll only sell something if he believes he can help you. And I didn't realize for the longest time that the reason why he always seems to have like 100% success rate on his actual sales is because he did such a great job qualifying everybody leading up to that. And it took me forever to understand how you just filter people out so that way you don't even waste your time on things that aren't going to ever be sales.
So then you were part of a startup called Canary?
Yeah. So, I mean, that was quite a bit later. No, I had gone out and started a career in software engineering and ended up being a programmer. And after about 4 years, I ended up in a position to where I had recognized an issue and was like, well, I'm going to give it a try. I'm going to give this whole startup thing a real try. I had tried a couple web development firms here and there, but like really trying to build a product. Canary was born out of my experience in trying to do test automation. And the goal with it was to create a system that could use AI and machine learning to really just automate the entire website testing process. It's a very finicky and difficult process that just is incredibly time consuming. So I was hoping to be able to fix that for the industry. And at the end of the day, we got really close, but we didn't have enough market indicators and revenue to be able to stay alive. So we ended up having to shut that down.
Okay.
Got really close though with the machine learning stuff. There was a lot of really groundbreaking work that we did on the back end. Just the product didn't fit right.
So how would it learn? Would it look at websites or would it watch humans interact with them? Or
it would go through the websites and interact with the websites as an erratic user. So we can't really simulate an actual user, but we could simulate a really erratic and like kind of stupid one. So that's what it would do. It would go through and it would map how everything worked and just try to like really digest how your system functions. And it would work along with you to be able to create what we call a baseline to say like, hey, this is how it's supposed to function. Because sometimes in development, not everything works like you want it to when you first build it. So you work along with an engineer. But the problem was that engineers didn't like doing QA and QA people didn't like being replaced. So we ended up having this problem where everybody thought it was a brilliant idea, but nobody really wanted to use the product. And mixed with our usability issues, the few people that were interested in giving it a try just found it unbearable to actually get around the AI. So,
okay. So it didn't need to know like, this screen needs addresses and this drop down is for this. So we just kind of figure it out as it went along.
Exactly.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's definitely one of the projects that I'm definitely the most proud of. The machine learning that came out of that was really quite fantastic. I spent like a year just building out the machine learning behind it to make all that possible. And we were actually recognized in 2019, so summer of last year at AI Dev World for leadership and transfer learning. Best in class. So it was a really good moment. Kind of sorrowful that 6 months later, the company ran into the end, but it was a good run. So Looksee is kind of my second take on that and trying to do something a little different. And what we're focused on now is just the experience. And I think that that was always the initial goal and we just didn't see it. Looksee is really about automating how you do the evaluations for your experience and helping you really surface problems quickly so that way you're not doing really long, tedious processes, essentially, to find out what sucks about your website. So there's a lot of things that you're doing well, but there's a lot of things that people will miss, you know, and things that we hear a lot from just regular users are things as simple as like grammar. The grammar on the site just doesn't make any sense, or there's punctuation and spelling errors everywhere. There are great services like Grammarly, so we're not focused exactly on that piece. But that's what started the thought process in my head, is just listening to my friends complain about the stupid little minutia that make them decide they don't ever want to visit that site again. And they'd be like really pedantic things, I feel like. But, you know, it's a big part of the user experience. And our goal is to really help bring some objectivity by using science and the scientific foundations of experience design to really help the industry have a more predictable process for making sure that they're releasing something that their users are going to at least kind of enjoy and help them iterate towards a delightful experience instead of just constantly throwing something against the wall and really just hoping for the best at the end of the day.
Now, does this tie in with any sort of A/B testing at all or figuring out what people like better?
It very well could, and that's likely something that could end up as an integration for us to where we'll be able to take our learnings and pin it with your A/B tests to, one, help make us smarter, but two, to help you decide what to test. Some things will convert better than others, but some things, it could be a this or that type of situation, and having A/B tests in there will be helpful, but it's not something that we're focusing on. There are plenty of companies that do A/B tests spectacularly, and I wouldn't dare to say that I could do it better.
Yeah, well, integrating with it sounds like it could make sense. What is the platform? What's it built on and how long have you been working on it?
I've been working on Looksee now since January of this year. And I can't even say that I've been working on it in the sense of like building it. We don't have a platform at the moment that people can use. It's a service that we're offering. And we're really just working with early customers to help us fine tune our evaluation process. Because one of the things that we did to be able to make this work is when I went out and started looking for like how people do evaluations, it's all based on heuristics, which are great guidelines, but they're just that. They're incredibly broad guidelines. And how you interpret those is really subjective from person to person. So we really just want to bring some objectivity into that process. And to do that, we had to create our own proprietary evaluation based on a number of industry best practices and research that underpins it.
Okay, so it's a services offering empowered by your AI and ML stuff that you've been doing.
Exactly. Our hope is to be able to get to a platform within the next 6 months. Right now, we're just trying to make sure that we're building something that people love, because I really don't want to make the same mistake that I made with Canary. I spent a couple of years building something that didn't arrive to much fanfare. So I'm trying to not make the same mistake this time.
Yeah, it's tempting as an engineer because you're able to build stuff to take an idea and build it as opposed to go in the reverse and see if anyone wants to buy it and if there is a market for it before you build line one.
As an engineer, it's definitely hard sometimes to take my hands off the keyboard, but it has been incredibly helpful and I'm in a much better place now with Looksee than where we were with Canary at this point, you know, the same process.
Very good. Well, when you are away from keyboard, what are you up to and what do you enjoy?
You know, I'm a civil person. I like to truly get away from the keyboard and unplug. So I like to do a lot of camping, hiking, and snowboarding. I just actually went out to Western Mass here for camping over Labor Day. And man, there is nothing better than just unplugging for 5 days.
Where'd you go in Western Mass?
It is the Clarksburg State Park out there. It's a small park with a little lake, but there's really not much for service. And it's a wonderful place to just unplug and get away. So I did that recently. Really looking forward to snowboarding season coming into play. I'm not sure how that's going to work out with COVID, but man, I'm looking forward to get some powder on the board.
I talked to some folks who know people at Stratton, and I guess they're planning to open for real.
Oh, are they?
Just trying to figure out the date and how to socially distance everyone on the mountain and in the lodge.
I might have to make a trip out there then this year. I try to, you know. I don't make it every year, but I try to make it out there once a year if I can.
Yep. Do you ride usually East Coast, West Coast?
West Coast. You know, I learned to board and to ski here on the East Coast, but how anybody could love it here is beyond me. It's just so icy.
Some of my best days ever snowboarding were in New England. But yeah, you get consistently good, amazing days out west, that's for sure. What are your favorite places in Colorado?
I've really only been to Breckenridge in Colorado, and I'd like to explore more. I admittedly make it more out to Montana, but I really loved Breck. I have to say that Breckenridge is probably one of my favorite mountains.
Where do you go in Montana?
When I go out there, it's usually to Red Lodge. I've been wanting to make it to Big Sky, but it's always the hike, it seems like, so I never quite make it out there.
Would you call yourself an expert? Are you riding the double black diamonds? You ride out of bounds? Where do you go?
I'll try the double black diamonds. I'm probably better suited for the single blacks. I've had a couple of moments where I've tried the double blacks and I've gotten myself into some sticky situations. Like a few years ago, I was out with a bunch of friends out of Breckenridge, 20 guys, I would say, really rowdy bunch, and didn't realize this at the time, but they're all much more experienced than I am at snowboarding. And we had a great first couple of days, and then they suddenly shifted gears, and now they're going to the summit. I was like, this is great. You know, I've got the warm-ups. We're good to go. So I follow these guys up. We go to the top of where the chair will take you, and up there, there's really nothing. It's just a bowl, you know. Never been this high up on a mountain before. I'm terrified of heights. You know, try to stay on the path because boards are slippery, and get over to this bowl, and I'm looking down. It's a 20-foot drop. And I was like, this is terrifying. I had to give myself a whole pep talk to get off that mountain, to be honest with you. And I did. I made the leap, and I hit powder, and I was like, oh, I'm still on my feet. This is great. So I start to carve a little bit, and I must have made it 3 or 4 heel toes. And then just, I was literally going head over toe. And it was a little terrifying at first, you know, and it finally came to an end. And I was like, oh, not doing that again.
I've been out to Colorado a few times. I really like Wolf Creek down in southern Colorado. The most snow in Colorado is their tagline. They get like 480 inches a year. And they don't have a huge vertical, maybe, I want to say 1,700 feet or something like that. But they're so high up. And they're just getting dumped on all the time. You're going anywhere near there, you have to have chains on your tire. Like it's the real deal. They have this cool bowl that I want to say is on like the south or west end of the resort. And then it kind of goes into like a glade, tree skiing. And then you get to the bottom and you're actually out of bounds. It's not lift service. It's not really part of the ski area. But they send a snowcat over every 20 minutes or so with a big tow rope behind it and a bunch of handles. And the skiers and the snowboarders just pick it up and then get towed right back to the base of the mountain and hop on the lift again.
That's really cool. I haven't made it out there before. I'm going to have to check that out. Yeah, hopefully I can make it this year. I was really thinking that nothing's going to be open, so that changes things.
Yeah, travel's still a big question mark, but everyone's chomping at the bit to open up.
You can drive.
Yeah, you could. Good, that'd be a little bit of a drive. One question I thought of, is your dad still in the industry?
He is, yeah. He is a CTO at Squad. He still schools me every once in a while.
What is Squad? I hadn't heard of them.
You know, to be honest with you, I'm not sure I could tell you exactly what they do. I believe that their main product is to do ad placement for TV networks, but I could be wrong on that.
Okay.
He's not really in the product as much as leading the technical organization. So every once in a while, he'll show me something cool that they've worked on, but I don't always understand what's going on when I look at it, to be honest with you, because it's so outside of my realm of normal things that I work on.
Yeah, yeah, understood. Folks, we are on season 3 of Underserved, and time has certainly flown by. If you like the content of this episode and have not yet rewound your listening to season one, be sure to check out episode 12 from season one called Rise of the Machines. Episode 12 features our guest Russ Wilcox and covers similar topics on artificial intelligence and machine learning. Russ and Brandon actually know one another, proving once again it is a small world after all, at least in the Boston software development scene. You can hear that episode, as well as the rest of seasons 1 and 2, at our website, underserved.fm. That is underserved.fm, Frank Mary, like FM radio. You can listen to the Underserved podcast right in your browser there, or there are links for all the popular podcast players, Apple, Google, Stitcher, etc., as well as an RSS feed link. Our talent agents are also looking for guests to be on Underserved. If you are interested in being a guest on the show, you can email us at underserved@syrinx.com. That's underserved@syrinx.com. Well, Brandon, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us this afternoon.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And we'll talk to you all very soon on the next episode of Underserved.